This is Taiwan Bound, the English language podcast of Tel Aviv University. Please welcome your host, Ido Aharoni, Tel Aviv University's graduate, member of the Board of Governors, lecturer, writer, and veteran diplomat.
Welcome to yet another episode of Tao Unbound. I'm Ido Aharoni, your host, and it is my pleasure to host here in our studio Professor Menachem Meni Mautner. Such a pleasure to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for giving me the opportunity.
It's a wonderful pleasure because I'm reading about you and I'm so impressed by your biography. For our viewers and our listeners, let me just say that Professor Mautner, now Professor Emeritus, is a very well-known law professor in Israel. He's a professor of comparative civil law and jurisprudence at Tel Aviv University. And in the years 2000 to 2002, he also served as the dean of the Faculty of Law, which is constantly ranked in the top in Israel. Only recently I saw that there's like an incredible percentage of the graduates who do extremely well in the workforce. Now, Professor Mautner also spent time, significant time, in the United States, Michigan Law School, NYU Law School, Cardiff Law School, Harvard Law School, Venice International University, and he also taught at Columbia University.
And Yale, of course.
And Yale, of course. Well, someone needs to add that to your Wikipedia page, but I'm sure it's in there somewhere. But you are also a well-known name in Israel because you regularly publish articles in the daily press. And so one of the reasons I wanted to host you in the podcast today is to discuss your, extracurricular activities, if you may.
Yeah, I like the medium of the press. I like writing in the press because you have to condense your thoughts to something like 600 or 700 words. Since my return from my PhD studies in the States, I used to publish 2 or 3 times a year. But 6 years ago, my first granddaughter was born, and I decided that I'll publish much more. So now I think I'm publishing between 8 to 10 times a year because I wanted to influence the world in which my granddaughter, now my 5 grandchildren, will grow up and live.
So your commitment is really to promote the collective good. This is your commitment, and we'll talk about all of that. But before that, tell us a little bit about your upbringing, your personal background. I know you grew up in Tel Aviv. What made you choose the area of law?
Actually, I grew up less than a mile from here, where I'm sitting now, from the lovely campus of Tel Aviv University. Since a young age, I had a fascination with the written word. I read a lot. I wrote. I immensely enjoyed writing. Writing gave me the opportunity to organize my thoughts and emotions. For me to see a blank page being filled up with words gave me a thrill. So since very young age, I knew that I'll spend my life in the humanities. I picked up law, but I could have as much chosen literature, history, political theory, sociology. I picked up law. I liked the argumentative element in the law. And I think that I picked up law because I knew that law is especially important because law determines the normative world in which we live, and law determines the distribution of resources in the society in which we live.
By the way, and I must say, in your writings, I can see a deep understanding of society.
Yeah, I'm doing my best. I hope I'm doing well. But for me, being a graduate of the law school, you cannot understand law except within the context of the social environment in which it operates and the political environment.
Yes, and that leads me to your specialty, which is civil law and jurisprudence. If you can tell us a little bit about that aspect of your academic work.
I've been teaching the way professors teach in the United States. In the morning, so to speak, you teach a black letter law, contracts, torts, etc. And in the afternoon, so to speak, you teach a jurisprudential course. So I taught contract law in the mornings, which kept me practice law, the black letter law. And then I taught seminars in law and culture, law and multiculturalism, state and religion, jurisprudence, etc. So it was a nice combination, very common in the elite law schools of the United States.
Now, I noticed something that you had written some months ago about what connects you to Israel. First of all, I should mention you are a proud Israeli and you've been very active on behalf of the pro-democracy forces in the last year since the attempt of the Israeli government to change the legal system. And your definition of what connects you to Israel is something that really drew my attention. You compared it to a house.
Yeah.
And you said, you know, it's enough for many people to connect to Israel, to fight for Israel, to love Israel, to feel patriotic feelings for Israel, only because it's their home.
Exactly. I mean, I immensely love Israel. Israel, and in particular the city of Tel Aviv, are very precious for me. I was born here. I spent most of my life, except for the years spent in the United States, here in Tel Aviv, in Israel. So Israel is very precious to me. And when I ask myself what connects me to Israel, my answer is very mundane, very simple, very prosaic. Israel for me is a home. And I follow here the writings of the great essayist Jean Amiry, the great sociologist Zygmunt Bauman, and of course Alexis de Tocqueville, the author of Democracy in America. For all three of them, home is the place in which you feel relaxed, you laid back, where you very easily decipher the cultural codes that surround you. So it's a matter of culture. We all know the experience. We go abroad into another culture and we are tense, we are not sure we are understanding the situation appropriately, we are not sure we are not committing some faults. A home is the place in which there's the utmost fit between your mind categories and the culture in which you live and operate. And Israel, for me, is a home in that very mundane, very prosaic, existential sense. So I don't need the right wing of Israel. For them, a home is the place where the Jewish people was shaped up, the places which are mentioned, that are mentioned in the Bible. I mean, needless to say, I have the utmost respect for the Bible. But I don't need the Bible. I don't need any theology to connect me to this place. For me, it's much more basic. It's a home. I don't need any justification except for the justification that this is the place in which I feel the best in the world. And I have a lot of appreciation, of course, for the cultural products of the last 140 years in literature, in poetry, etc.
So you represent a very basic approach. So without discounting the importance of all the lofty ideas and the ideologies and the theologies and so on, you say, yes, I'm connected to this place simply, this is my home. And it's a very powerful argument, I must say. Now, you mentioned de Tocqueville. De Tocqueville, which I also teach in my classes, in the 1830s, way before the United States became a global power, he was already able to identify the structural elements that would turn America into a global power. Now, I'm asking you, in reverse, what are the structural elements that put Israel in danger?
De Tocqueville is a fantastic case of a very young man who traveled horse riding in the United States for 18 months and then published this book that is being taught in every course of the social sciences and the humanities and law in the United States. It's a fascinating story. What a brilliant young man he was. The problems of Israel, I think the number one problem is the war of culture within which we live. The Kulturkampf that takes place in Israel. The Kulturkampf erupted for the first time in the 1770s, in the second half of the 18th century in Berlin, with the rise of Jewish Enlightenment. And following the rise of Jewish Enlightenment, the Jewish Enlightenment movement, the Kulturkampf, the War of Cultures, erupted. And there were two options in the war. One is pro-Western, secular, liberal, and the other is pro-Halachic, which wants to tie Jewish culture more strongly to Jewish religious heritage. And the War of Culture, this War of Culture was being fought, so to speak, with differing, with varying intensities for the past 250 years. It re-erupted in the 1970s in Israel, and with very high intensity. And this disagreement about the very fundamentals of our life here, this is the number one fact, I think, about Israel. It has been the number one fact about Israel for the past 50 years, since the re-eruption of the War of Cultures between these two cultural options, with very high intensity.
Now, correct me if I'm wrong, but what you're describing is the tension between the two ends of the Jewish spectrum. On one end, the universalist approach, right, that speaks on behalf of universal values, and the other is what sociologists would call the particularistic approach, meaning
exactly
highlighting the differences, the uniqueness of Jewish experience. Now, State of Israel is the product of the vision and the pragmatism and the execution of the universalists. Even Ben-Gurion was a universalist at the end of the day.
Yeah.
But demographic changes change the political landscape. And so you have a very unique approach, which I read about what Israeli society needs to do now when there is a clash, and the clash is on the surface. It's happening. It's one of the reasons for the perception of Israel's weakness by Israel's enemies that probably prompted, or at least one of the reasons for the attack on October 7th, is the perception that Israel is weak. What do you think can be done now when this conflict is on the surface?
I don't know of any other political theory that is suitable to situations of diversity and conflict other than liberalism. A prime value in liberalism is toleration. A prime value in liberalism is that every individual, every group would live the way of life he or she or the group chooses. So Israel is still a liberal democracy, and we have to cherish and safeguard Israel's liberalism, because, as I said, in situations of diversity and conflict, there's no better political theory than liberalism. We have to add to that the concept and the notions of multiculturalism, which I think are very fruitful and pertinent and important. And multiculturalism stands for the understanding that we are all being shaped up by our cultures, and that our cultures are very important for us, and that we have to be tolerant to the utmost extent possible about cultural practices. So these two concepts, liberalism on the one hand and multiculturalism on the other, I think are very relevant to Israel, to the Israeli situation, which is a situation of very profound conflict between two struggling cultural options.
Now, your analysis of what's happening in Israeli society is analysis that is looking at the role of the elites. And you're using the case of the legal system to make that argument. And I'm paraphrasing, but basically what you're saying is that the Israeli elite was in a mode of retreat because of the changing demographics, and they held on to the legal system, and that became the battlefield.
Exactly. That my interest is in the law, and in the 1980s we have been witnessing three far-reaching changes in the jurisprudence of the Supreme Court of Israel: the rise of sweeping judicial activism, the turn from a formalistic style of legal reasoning to a value-laden style which exposes the normative meaning and implications of the law, and the change in the self-perception of the law from an institution whose major task is to resolve disputes to an institution which acts politically, a political institution. So these are far-reaching changes that took place.
And it attracted fire from politicians.
Exactly. So that incited my interest, because in a very short span of time, the Supreme Court effected three far-reaching changes in its jurisprudence. And we have to remember, a court in the Anglo-American system, and including in Israel, acts within a tradition. A court has to show deference to its precedents. And this was not the case with the Israeli Supreme Court in the 1980s. So I asked myself, what was the reason for these very far-reaching changes? And a second question, how come that nobody really objected to them significantly? And my answer was that we have to understand that the Supreme Court of Israel is the number one state institution that acts for the introduction of liberal values into the political culture of the country on the one hand. So this is the bastion of liberalism in terms of state institutions on the one hand. And on the other hand, there was an overlap in the interest between this liberal institution and the liberal group in Israel. And the liberal group in Israel chose to conduct its political struggles within the court by submitting hundreds and hundreds of petitions every year for the past 30 or 40 years. I think this is a spoiled and ineffective way of doing politics. For me, politics should be done on the ground with people, and the most important thing about politics is the creation of an eye contact in a face-to-face interaction. The Israeli liberals, I think, committed a great historical error and mistake in taking their political struggles to the Supreme Court. And it was easy, again, an easy arena for them because of the overlap, the identity between the liberal values of the liberal group and the state, at the court as a liberal institution. But historically, it was a terrible mistake, I think. There's no other way of doing effective politics. But when you meet people, talk to them, listen to them, learn from them, what are their grievances, what are their problems, addressing them, and again, contacting, creating the eye contact, in the face-to-face interaction. This is the strongest encounter we have with other human beings. We can lecture to people, we can write in the internet, etc. These are less effective means for creating bonding and influence between individuals and influencing human beings.
And this started in the 1980s.
In
the 1980s, this is the time of the National Unity Government.
Exactly.
Shamir, Peres, and later on Shamir government. The decade started with Menachem Begin's government going into Lebanon and so on. So you say this was a convenient solution for the elite. Rather than engage in real-life bottom-up politics, what they chose to do is go to the Supreme Court and play in the arena, which was more comfortable for them, but was not effective politically.
And doing top-down politics rather than bottom-up, as you said.
Yeah, and I think it's a very valid analysis. Now, fast forward, we are where we are today. Israeli society is divided. What would you recommend for the so-called liberal elite or the liberals in general to do in order to reverse the course of this historical process that you're describing?
First of all, I realize it, that doing politics is a very hard work. I mean, you know, it's very hard. I don't have any illusions. But I think the Israeli liberals need to approach the peripheries, to go to the peripheries, both Jewish peripheries and the Arab periphery, and create alliances with the people who live in the peripheries, again, learn from them about their grievances, about their problems. And the Israeli liberals, is the liberals in Israel are the most educated group in the country. They can provide the peripheries with good education in terms of classes of English, mathematics, the humanities, etc. The state does a very problematic job in educating people in the peripheries. So we can supplement that by going to the peripheries and create frameworks of interaction with the people through classes that we would teach. That's my program and my plan in the afternoons. And when you teach in the afternoon, the teachers, then in the evenings, the mothers and the fathers highly appreciate it, what you're doing for your children. They are thankful. They invite you to their homes for dinner. And you create the human interaction. And when you create the human interaction, that's the beginning of real political bonding. Now, again, I think we have to show interest in these people, and we failed to do that for the past 40 or 50 years. When you talk to these people, and I had the opportunity to talk to them, they feel neglected. They think that we encapsulated ourselves in our own good life, gave good education to our children, went abroad, built up our careers, made some money. We have to change this pattern and to create much deeper contacts between Israeli liberals, which are more affluent, more better, highly educated, more globalists, etc. So we have to create much stronger contacts between them and all the rest.
Well, let me ask you a question about the vision. State of Israel, the modern state of Israel, is the product of a very effective vision that said the solution to the so-called Jewish problem is statehood. And it was Theodor Herzl and Chaim Weizmann and Ben-Gurion, they executed the vision. But once we had a state, the main task became to protect the state, to allow economic growth, you know, immigration absorption and so on. But the main task was to protect the state. That's why the IDF became the centerpiece of life in Israel. I have a feeling, and again, I read it between the lines of your pieces, that there's a crisis of vision.
Yeah.
What would you recommend? Should it be going back to Theodor Herzl's vision?
Well, Altneuland is a terrific book. I mean, it's not Dostoevsky or Tolstoy, okay. But it's a very he was a very capable writer, I have to say. And I like Altneuland, by the way. But what really, we have to put our finger on the most important process that took place within Zionism, Jewish nationalism, in the past 50 or 60 years. Every national movement is built on the, has got three elements. A group of people connected by a shared national historical memory, a language, a culture, etc. That's the first element. Second is a territory, a national territory. And the third is the aspiration to for political sovereignty, okay? Now, what happened in Jewish nationalism, in Zionism, in the past five decades is that the element of the territory become prominent. Israel's right wing made a great historical decision that the number one goal of Jewish nationalism is to stick to the West Bank, to the West Bank, now Gaza, and under the auspices of the occupation, to expand the settlement project. Now, this is a great historical decision of Israel's right wing. For me, it's a wrong decision. The number one decision should have been, the number one goal should have been the attainment of peace with the Palestinian national movement. And I think that we are paying the very high prices of
now,
this.
Let me ask you a question. Because obviously, to talk about peace in the context of the kind of relations between the United States and Canada, sounds detached from reality for most Israelis post 10/7. So obviously, I'm assuming that when you're talking about peace as a legal expert, you're talking about a livable arrangement, right? Some sort of a legal arrangement that will allow both people to live side by side without killing each other and living normally. But here's my question to you. So when we say, and I'd like to go back to Theodor Herzl. Theodor Herzl talked about this Jewish state that will be a light unto the nations. Question is, what comes first? Is it first to create an exemplary, you know, society, and then peace will become whatever livable arrangement will become a byproduct of that society based on enlightenment and science and all the values that you mentioned under the umbrella of the universalist approach to Judaism.
And that are part of Altneuland, Herzl's Altneuland.
Exactly. You know, Herzl, I mean, you mentioned Altneuland. I recently reread it. It's incredible how he was able to predict traffic jams in Israel. He was able to predict trains. He even predicted Haifa, because Haifa in 1902, when the book came out, was a fisherman village.
Exactly.
It was incredible.
Incredible. He's a gifted writer, and it's a very powerful book.
Yeah.
Very naive in a lot of ways.
Right, because he writes about the fact that we don't need an army, and that the superpowers will protect us and so on. But
Rashid Bey, the Arab protagonist, will love Jewish nationalism because it will create economic prosperity. So the founder of Jewish nationalism, was not aware of the importance of Palestinian nationality. Right,
right.
Nationalism.
Right.
So,
he did write about women's right to
vote. Exactly.
In the late 19th century. Anyhow, so to go back to that, what comes first? An enlightened society that then will produce a livable arrangement? Or first, because here's my thought. In the 1980s, the Israeli political echelon, instead of doing what you're saying, instead of building bridges to the periphery, instead of showing them that they're not being neglected, they were busy making peace, especially Shimon Peres, and who was not known for his connection to the Israeli periphery, but he was well known all over the world for his efforts to make peace, right? Maybe the order should have been reversed. First, a light unto the nations, then peace.
You will not have an exemplary state, a light for all other nations, without peace. And I would say the contrary as well. If we won't have peace, we shall deteriorate in terms of our values. And if we won't have peace, eventually we'll end up with an extreme right-wing regime. So peace is essential. Israel's left wing was right. Peace should have been the number one, the top priority for the country. In that respect, they were right. I criticize them for failing to establish strong contacts with the periphery, but they identified the number one problem of the country, which is the continuation of violence between Israelis and Arabs, Israelis and Palestinians after that. So peace is essential. Without peace, the future of Israel will be very bleak. A series of violent conflicts between us and the Palestinians will eventually erode Israel's liberal democratic regime, and we shall become a country governed by a right-wing regime, to put it mildly.
Yeah, and I think you said in one of your pieces that you can be a religious person in a liberal state, but it's almost impossible to be a liberal person in a religious state.
Yes, exactly. And that's why liberalism is so important for a situation of conflict and multiculturalism.
Now, when you look at the at the Israeli society, and I know that the jury is still out. It's too early. We're only a few months after the attack. The war hasn't ended. What kind of Israeli society will emerge post 10/7 in your view?
I don't really know. As the Americans say, it's very difficult to prophesy recently, particularly about the future, right? So I really don't know. I'm not sure I have a good sense. I don't feel that I have a good sense of what goes on. It's too early. We are only 5 months after this really watershed, this terrible event. I'm very pessimistic in the sense that I see a civil war between the two strifing camps within a year, 2 or 3 years. So, but I can't say that I have a good sense of what really goes on around me right now. I'm doing my best, but I'm not sure I fully understand or appropriately understand.
So your concern is that this could deteriorate into a full-blown conflict between the two camps in Israel.
Yeah, because I don't want to sound too bleak and too pessimistic, but if the world will pressure Israel to have some peace arrangement with the Palestinians, which would involve territorial concessions, Israel's right wing won't accept it. And Israel's right wing has got elements in it that are highly violent. They showed it in 1995. If necessary, from their perspective, they will become violent again if they would feel that the country, that the state is about to embark on a political arrangement with the Palestinians, which would involve territorial concessions. In 1995, the right wing did not face any opposition because, as you said and I said, we were busy with improving our standards of living, doing the good life, etc. Now the Israeli left wing is armed and organized following the protests of which began after the Yariv Levin plan of January 4th, 2023. So this time, unlike in 1995, now if there's a severe disagreement, the right wing of Israel will encounter a left wing which is armed, experienced, with a lot of self-confidence after the 9 months of the protest movement and after taking care of all the evacuees, both in the north and in the south. That is not very promising. This prospect is very dangerous.
And you see two groups that feel empowered and feel emboldened by the situation and have the means to carry out their vision.
And the right wing will be assisted by the police, of course. The police is now being governed by an ultra-rightist politician, which works very hard to create an institutional change in this very important institution. So if there's violence between these two strifing groups in the society, the police will stand at the side of the right wing. There's no doubt about that.
Yeah. Now, let me ask you one last question because we are running out of time, and I want to leave our viewers and our listeners on a high and positive note. Let's assume that there is going to be some sort of a political constellation that will bring about the reshuffling of the cards and a new government sometime in the future. Do you see any of those processes that you described as reversible?
Well, that's a tough question. I don't know. I mean, I always believe that we have choice. There are no... It's reversible if we have goodwill and wisdom. And if we approach the other side and try to understand, do our best to understand what motivates the other side. human beings usually fail to do that. That's why we have so many violent conflicts, wars, etc.
Right, right. As I learned as a diplomat, war is very natural to humankind. Diplomacy, not so much.
Exactly.
But what you're offering is actually there's a strong optimism here and a ray of hope. You're saying it's all about education. It's all about bottom-up engagement. It's all about active listening, listening to the other side, what concerns them, and then try to address it.
I couldn't have not summed it up better, you know.
Well, it was such a pleasure to spend those 30 minutes with you, and hopefully we'll get to host you here again.
I'd be delighted, and thank you very much for having me.
Thank you for educating us and sharing your wisdom with us. And to our viewers and listeners back home, until our next episode, goodbye from Tel Aviv.